This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we are re-airing a forum on the issue of homelessness in Utah from the spring of last year. Since this forum was recorded, three new homeless resource centers have come online in Salt Lake County as part of a new model of tackling homelessness in our region. The opening of these shelters came in conjunction with the closure of the Road Home Shelter in November, ending nearly a century of use for that facility. However, the new shelters combined have several hundred fewer beds than the Road Home, which itself previously suffered from overflow problems. This crunch on occupancy has received pushback from citizens, activists, and some political leaders in the state who worry many will not be able to find shelter this winter. These tensions were displayed in recent acts of civil disobedience by local interest groups. In November, public commenters and protesters stopped a Salt Lake City Council meeting to demand that the Road Home be allowed to remain open into 2020. Earlier this month, activists occupied Washington Square with tents and other camping equipment to ask for specific changes to how the homeless population is treated. 17 protesters were arrested when police broke up the encampment on city ordinance violations. Newly sworn in Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall and other officials have made assurances that no one will go without life-saving resources this winter, but that hasn't allayed all the concerns of homeless advocates. This forum we're airing today was recorded before a great deal of these actions took place, and obviously before a change in leadership in Salt Lake City's government. The forum featured homeless advocate Pamela Atkinson, North Salt Lake representative and licensed clinical social worker Sandra Hollins, and Salt Lake City Council member and Vice President of Program Operations of Volunteers of America, Utah, Andrew Johnston. Moderating the discussion is Rob Westman, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Utah. This forum was recorded on March 20th, 2019. Here's your moderator, Rob Westman.
So I'm Rob Westman, Executive Director of NAMI Utah. And I think how I want to start this is I think what we should do is we'll talk a little bit about our experience around this issue, because I think what we'll do afterwards is we'll get into some things like, you know, what's happening currently, hopefully some groundbreaking solutions from all of us, those kinds of things. So just real quickly, I've been doing this work for about 20 years, working with serious mental illness and people experiencing homelessness. You probably know there's a fairly big crossover between people experiencing homelessness and mental illness. And one of the things that NAMI really supports is increased access to treatment. Incarceration is not treatment for mental illness. I just want everyone to understand that. We were encouraged by some of the things that occurred the last legislative session in terms of hopefully increasing access. It wasn't exactly what we were hoping for, but you know, we'll take what we can get to start. So that's one of the things that we really want to focus on. But we're going to talk a little bit more about what the issue really is, and maybe you know what it is we want to do. So, Pamela, I'm looking at you. Why don't we start with you? Tell us your experience with this issue and kind of your take on what the issue is right now.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob. Is this on?
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you, Rob. I've been working with homeless people probably for about 25 years now. I'm a community advocate. I work with homeless people directly, those out on the streets, and many of those in some type of housing right now and in different programs. But then I also work with the providers. It really is a collaborative and team effort. But I also work as an advisor to Governor Herbert as part of his leadership and strategy team. And then I work with legislators, and as some of you know, we've just finished a legislative session late Thursday night. That was a long 17-hour day. And the last thing I was running around up at the Capitol was for money for affordable housing at 10 o'clock at night. It was supposed to be in the Bill of Bills, but it didn't make it. Housing and homelessness, you cannot separate them out. And somehow or other, some people have decided we should do that. But I have a lot of homeless friends who have taught me a great deal. They've taught me how individualistic they are. They've taught me about their goals and their hopes and their dreams. They've also taught me that one size does not fit all. And we talk about housing, but many of us are now talking about alternative types of housing. Whether it be those tiny homes people are talking about, but whether it be transitional housing, permanently supportive housing, or whether it's single room occupancy, there are all kinds of alternative housing. Many of my homeless friends, I'm happy to say, are now formerly homeless friends, and that's because of the great services that have been provided, whether it be case management, emergency shelter. But most of all, what it takes is caring about our homeless friends, as I said at the beginning, as individuals. But it is a listening ear. I'm convinced we were all given two ears and one mouth for a purpose. And I've been trying to listen more and more. And as I listen to our homeless friends, they're no different from many of us. And they just want to move on with their lives, but they need a little bit of help. And we're here to provide that help. Sandra and Andrew and Rob all have different positions than what I do. But if we collaborate, work as a team, and by the way, the acronym TEAM stands for T-E-A-M, together, everyone achieves more. And so we've had many, many successes in getting our homeless friends off the streets, into housing, into jobs. But there are still many who need help with their mental illness, with their drug addiction, with their other problems. And you are able to help them in different ways, just as we've done over the years.
Great, thank you. Pamela said a couple of pretty important things there. The solution to homelessness is housing. So that's another thing we want you to take from this meeting today. This is not, we do something locally called Housing First. And what that means is, let's take someone in whatever situation they are in, let's provide stable housing, and then sort out what else needs to happen. Many, many years ago, we would talk about things like housing ready. Gosh, you seem to have this untreated mental illness. You're not ready for housing yet. I hope we can all understand how silly that sounds. Everyone deserves a stable place to live. Then we can figure out what else is going on. So very important. So let's move to Representative Hollins. Let's hear some of your experience and what you've got in store for us.
Sure. As you said, I am Utah State Representative Sandra Hollins. I represent District 23, which is the northwest side of Salt Lake City. I first became interested in homelessness, believe it or not, when I was about 6 years old. I remember I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I remember being on a picnic with my class. And we had sack lunches, and I remember being in a park, and we were sitting in the park and eating our lunch on a blanket. And I remember this man came up with a shopping cart and started digging through the garbage can. And I remember sitting there wondering what was going on, because that was the first time I had ever seen that before and ever seen someone digging through the garbage can and wonder why. But you know, during that time, kids were seen and not heard, and so you didn't dare ask questions, but that just kind of always stayed in the back of my mind. And then from there, I just kind of noticed what was going on in my community. So life went on. I ended up going to college, graduating, and getting a job working for the federal government as a human resource specialist. And did that for a number of years, but was never ever happy with doing it. I've always wanted to be a social worker, but life kind of took me in a different direction. And so one day I decided I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going back to school and getting my master's degree in social work. And so that's what I did. All my friends and my husband thought I was out of my mind to quit a job where I was kind of moving up the ladder, was making pretty significant money, to give that up to become a social worker, because we all know who are social workers. We don't do it because we're trying to become wealthy. And so I became a social worker. My first job that I had, I did an internship with the Road Home, and then I did an internship with Volunteers of America. And I worked there for, close to 10 years. With working there, I worked in a lot of different roles. I was a case manager, I worked in housing, I worked as a therapist, I worked as a substance abuse specialist, and then I worked as the director of homeless outreach. And so I have a lot of experience working working with this population, and I must say I love it. Right now, I'm working for the city. I work for Salt Lake City as their homeless strategist and outreach coordinator. Love my job, love what I do. One thing I have to admit I miss is that one-on-one contact with actually being out on the streets and actually working in that connection with the individuals. One of the things I'm excited to see that along with the Housing First model that's out there is that now people are moving more towards trauma-informed care. As we all know, the majority of the individuals on the street, well, all of them on the street have experienced some type of trauma. Being homeless is trauma itself. It's trauma. And it's important that we start focusing on that if we're going to get people into housing. A lot of folks like to say, well, we have people who are refusing to go in and there's service resistance. These individuals who are traumatized, they're very traumatized. And I think that that's one of the most important things as we continue to look to address homeless issues in this area is that we're going to have to make sure that everyone is trauma-informed, trained. So.
Thank you. Okay, so something important that Sandra said, she mentioned service resistant. Has anyone ever heard that term? Yeah. So here's what we say. I'm the big, great, powerful therapist, and I say, do what I say and you'll be better. And you say, well, that's kind of silly. I don't want to do that. And then I say, well, you're being treatment resistant. So I'm going to give you a scenario. Let's say you go to Target, and right in the front of Target is all these like weird pickles, and they're forcing you to buy these weird pickles that you don't even like. And you're like, well, I don't want those pickles. Well, you're just being pickle resistant. And they force you to buy them. Sounds pretty silly, right? You don't buy those pickles, they get rid of them, they get something that you do want. So one of the things, the important things that the Representative Holland said about trauma-informed care is you understand that. That if my intervention isn't working, I gotta change my intervention. So when people say things like, oh, this person is choosing to be homeless, given the crummy choices they have, yes, that one provides me more autonomy, a little bit more freedom, et cetera, but it's still not a very good choice, right? So being trauma-informed means that we understand that if we attempt an intervention, and our customers, people experiencing homelessness, if they don't respond to it, we better start thinking about other interventions that are going to work. Okay, so let's move to Councilman Johnston. Give us your history, tell us what's going on.
Sure, I'm Andrew Johnston. My night job is on the Salt Lake City Council currently. I represent the west side, just south of Sandra's area. I started working in a homeless shelter in college, actually. It was back east in Maine, and I was in a little tiny town, about 25,000 people, and we had a 11-bed house that was our shelter, essentially, Tedford Shelter. And I just volunteered, I think it was Saturday mornings for a while, because nobody else would get up on a Saturday morning in college. And I did that for the 3 years, and I started taking jobs in the field and toyed with law school twice and decided I'd hate being a lawyer. So I kept taking nice, low-paying jobs that all end up being social worky kind of stuff. And over time, I did homeless outreach in Maine for kids under the age of 15. And I came back to Utah here. And actually, Sandra and I graduated at the same time from social work school here at the U. She's aged better than I have. And she's actually attained tremendous things since then. I started working at Volunteers of America as well, about the same time, actually. So we were coworkers for quite a while, and she left and went to bigger things in the city. And so I currently oversee homeless services for Volunteers of America and some other parts of that agency for my day job. When a couple things came up for me, number one, I don't like being in politics so much, but I love public policy. And there's a lot of drama in politics, but the public policy you can get is tremendous. I remember this 2 years ago, I think it was. I'm looking at David Litvak here, who is part of the city as well. And we spend a couple $1 million a year on homeless services in Salt Lake City only. And we're a small player in that. But we had a need at Operation Rio Grande, that area, a couple years ago. And we needed $500,000 for something or other. And in literally less than a couple days, we were able to allocate $500,000. Now, from working at a small nonprofit where I'm talking about just $1,000 here, I'm never going to see that in my lifetime for a homeless services application just out of the blue. So the levers I can pull in politics are much, much larger than I probably could in my day job as a social worker. So I love that piece about it. An interesting piece that's been brought up here was, we talk about housing. Housing is a big piece. And this week, as a city council, we talked about a very particular type of housing called SRO, single resident occupancy. Essentially, these are old ideas that come back again, like everything else in our world. Tiny homes now used to be trailer homes, right? But these are old ideas about I don't need a whole apartment. I need a bedroom and maybe a bathroom, a bedroom, maybe a little kitchenette. And I can share a bathroom or a kitchen with the rest of my floor. It's like a dorm, right, for adults. Old ideas coming back in fashion because it's cheaper to build. A lot of people don't want a full apartment anymore, and they want location over amenities kind of thing. But in part of that discussion, people are very, very concerned. There are a bunch of people who are going to move in here, and they're going to be vagrants, and they're going to cause problems in my neighborhood. That was what's happening, right? Just even well-meaning people will talk about this. We work on our fears, right? I don't want people who want a SRO in my neighborhood because somehow they are going to be less desirable than the people like me who are sharing a house, like the six of us kind of thing, right? Which is absurd. And one of the things that's interesting is we talked about a couple months ago about this accessory dwelling unit, a mother-in-law apartment in your house, basement, your attic, or above your garage, right? Big battles here in Salt Lake City about this, and nationwide, actually. This is not unique to us. But it's a cheaper form of housing that doesn't necessarily mean you put a big building up in a single-family lot. It's called a stealth density, we call it. It's already happening. I mean, if I were to ask, maybe I should. Anybody here living in a house with other people? Like a little apartment or a room or something? I did it for years, right? It wasn't legal in some places I did it, but I did it, right? We do a lot of this stuff. It's already happening across Salt Lake City in the area, but we think if we sort of make it public that all of a sudden it's going to be a big problem. What was interesting is they did a study in Portland, Oregon, which is sort of seen as a hotbed of this idea, right? Everybody in Portland's doing this. It's fad kind of thing. And only about 1% of people who could in Portland do it. But they did a study and said, all right, so people who rent these little mother-in-law apartments or ADUs, do they cause more nuisance problems for police in the neighborhood? And they did a study on this. And they found out that for those houses that had these, they didn't necessarily have more nuisance calls than any other house in the neighborhoods or in the district. What they did find was when they did have nuisance calls, the majority of them were the owner of the house, not the renter. It flips this perception on its head that people who are low income that need smaller places or have less to pay are problems, that we're the nuisance issues. We're going to cause the problems and bring down property values. The reality is sometimes the inverse. But a lot of our work is saying we have to get facts out there. We have to talk through these things in more logical ways in some ways, acknowledge the emotional piece of this, but talk through things in logical ways that it makes a lot of sense to help get housing for people. A lot of sense financially, I think morally, frankly, socially in a lot of ways for our issues that we're dealing with as a society as a whole. But we have to think about things in new terms and look at the data.
That's Andrew Johnston, Salt Lake City Council member and Vice President of Program Operations of Volunteers of America, Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion given earlier this year on unsheltered homelessness in Utah, its realities, causes, and potential solutions. Here again is moderator Rob Westman, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Utah.
So now what I want to talk about, from our perspective, why do people live unsheltered? Aren't there shelters? Aren't there resources for people? Why do people choose, lose the term, I'll use that loosely, but why do people end up unsheltered? Pamela, we'll start with you.
In order to answer that question, I go back to my homeless friends. And this is what they tell me. There's lots of reasons, Pamela. I like my independence. I like to be able to have a drink or a shop when I need it, or a sniff, or whatever they're into. But additionally, they tell me the right kind of housing is not available for them. We've talked a little about the single room occupancies. The ideal SROs, as we call them, would be 175 square feet. And there would be five rooms that would share a bathroom and a shower. That's what's happening across the country and some here. And that's what some of our homeless friends want, with a community dining room, a community room to have visitors and play games that community organizations bring in. But just a little place where they can socialize, but a room where they can be on their own. They like their privacy as much as we do. But many of our homeless friends have varying degrees of mental illness. And this precludes them from certain type of housing. And they are out on the street. Sometimes when the weather is down in the single digits, we have to go out and find our homeless friends with mental illness because they don't know that there's shelter somewhere and we can bundle them up in our cars and take them to the road home or St. Vincent's. But people will just tell you they don't feel safe in a shelter because there are other people going through their personal items. There are other people doing drugs. They'll say there are bed bugs, there's fleas, there's all kinds of things. But there's a litany of reasons as to why they still stay out on the street. And when they give the reasons for staying out of shelter, then it's our responsibility and our jobs to make sure they have several blankets, several sleeping bags, and that they're zipped up and have a hood over their head so they don't freeze at night. But if somebody wants to stay unsheltered, we need to respect that and try to work with them to find out how we can make it easier for them to come in out of the various elements and other things that are out there.
And you said it very well here.
Thank you.
I see it in the home shelter, as I realize it personally of some acquaintances down at the street.
Thank you.
You said it very well.
Thank you.
And I want to add to that also everything that Pamela said, but also there are some individuals who are so severely mentally ill that they're incapable of making that decision for themselves, or they are into their addiction that they're incapable of making those decisions for themselves. But also there are individuals who are scared to go in. I remember I had this one client who we finally got into housing. We got him into an apartment and he didn't want to sleep inside. He had a hard time adjusting to being indoors because he didn't feel safe being indoors. And so what we ended up doing is allowing him to sleep indoors once a week until we were outside. Until we were able to get him adjusted to being indoors. If you think about it, for a lot of us, sleeping outside is out of our norm. That's not normal to us, unless we're going camping. But being outdoors all the time is not normal. So for some people who've been on the streets for a long period of time, the idea of adjusting inside is not the norm. And this is where we need our mental health workers and our outreach workers to be able to be there to help people adjust through that transition phase.
Awesome. A little plug right here. So Does anyone know about the mobile crisis outreach teams that operate out of Uni? Couple. So one of the things, and we were talking about this before this event started, an appropriate response to someone in the street having a mental health issue, a mental illness crisis, et cetera, should that be a trained mental health professional or a police officer?
A trained mental health professional, because the police officer has an arrogance to their thinking that of authority.
Well, possibly. Or CIT. So now what we want to do is, what is the best response is someone who is trained to handle that situation. And so what we've got is we do have, so CIT is crisis intervention teams. It's actually something that NAMI developed about 25 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, something like that. And basically that's a training program for police officers to understand how to respond to mental health conditions in the community. However, what we've been doing locally for a few years is these mobile crisis outreach teams. They are social workers and peer support folks who go out to respond to a call that is indicating some sort of mental health crisis. By and large, people having mental health crises in the community are not dangerous. They simply need mental health services and treatment. So what we're finding is there's that huge gap. Then if we lump that in as people begin to lose supports in the community, et cetera, then they begin experiencing homelessness, substance use disorders come about, the co-occurring substance use and mental illness is very high with people experiencing homelessness, and the mental illness component to people experiencing, especially unsheltered homelessness, is very high. It's pretty hard to measure. 60 to 90% is our best guess right now of people who are unsheltered on the streets. So again, as we talk about, you know, Pamela, you said very well that if folks aren't able to access a housing, you know, opportunity that we're able to provide, we need to work with them to see what will work, have them trust us. We had also mentioned about the trauma-informed component. Understanding that trauma plays into why someone has such a hard time going indoors. So if we understand that and just work with someone, and the intervention that you were able to take was perfect. So just understanding those, there's a whole bunch of factors. Andrew.
And just when we talk about mental illness or mental health issues or barriers, trauma we think of as big T trauma, right? Capital T trauma. Big things happen to us, it's awful, I can define that event, change the course of my life in a negative way. I feel it, right? But a lot of us don't have that necessarily in our lives. A lot of us have a lot of little T traumas. Either there are specific events that happened once, twice, multiple times, or it's a daily experience of adversity that doesn't get easier. And you know, most of us are sort of taught, you get better at it, right? Just get stronger and deal with it. But that doesn't always work very well, because we know from a lot of research that the more difficult life and death decisions you have to make on a daily basis, the worse you get at it later in the day. After about 7, we're lousy at this stuff. We just wear down. Physically, we can't handle the stress of doing that constantly. So you can think of poverty as a little T constant trauma where you're always trying to survive. For some of the folks we're talking about, it's not necessarily they had a massive awful event, although a lot of them had really traumatic experiences in childhood or adulthood or both. We know from our youth that about 80% of them typically say they were abused in some capacity before they became homeless. And about the same amount say they were abused after they became homeless. It's dangerous to be unsheltered in a lot of ways. So we're not necessarily saying it's a person who has schizophrenia and everyone out on the street's like that. No, there's actually quite a few folks who have significant barriers who maybe are using drugs and alcohol for really legitimate reasons to tamp down their symptoms. Once they get some stability and some support, it's hard to assess for addiction, because once we get more stability in our lives, like a place to stay constantly that we feel safe in, and maybe a social network or a few people we trust who can listen to us, oftentimes we don't use the drugs and alcohol nearly as much. It drops way, way down. It's not a dependence necessarily. So we gotta be careful sometimes in saying we wanna get stability. Housing First is exactly like this. Get some stability and then help assess what is actually happening here? Because oftentimes we think, all right, let's get him into a drug and alcohol treatment program, right? It'll take care of it. And no, it hasn't actually. I love drug and alcohol treatment programs if they're good, but we got to deal with the root cause here. If somebody's homeless and they're drinking, it shouldn't be a crime. If I'm housed and I'm drinking, is it a crime? Theoretically, if I'm overage, right? But yeah, if I'm in my own house, a lot of the things we criminalize for the homeless are totally legal in my own house. So housing tends to be the crux here again. Talk about where I feel safe and can be housed, and then I can deal with a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, I have a question for the panelists. There seems to be a lot of judgment, and you got to this a little bit, Andrew. There seems to be a lot of judgment around people experiencing homelessness, such as, well, just get a job and you'll be okay. You know, you are lazy and that's why you're experiencing homelessness. You aren't doing something you are supposed to, and then this is the result. Talk a little bit about that, because we've all worked with folks. So talk a little bit about that in terms of how that affects people experiencing homelessness.
I think Pamela might be a good person in first-time experience with the homeless, because they'll tell you stories, right? They'll tell you what it's like to be homeless downtown on the street and be walking down the sidewalk and not make eye contact with anybody because you're trying to be invisible. Or assuming that everybody walking by you is a threat in some capacity, because your experience is that most people are threatening in some way. Either just the emotional peace I feel from them, or they actually yell at me, or disregard me, or ignore me. I'm not saying that there aren't legitimate concerns, but sometimes the way we interact with the homeless contributes to them feeling like they are still not worthy of things. They're not worthy of housing, they're not worthy of the things. And we talk about learned helplessness sometimes, and probably people in this room have felt that sometimes. I can't do anything to change my situation. I might just give up right now, or at least temporarily, right? Disengage. That is true for everybody, not just us and the homeless. We all have that reaction sometimes. So we have to think a lot about our own interactions with our homeless, as Pamela would say, friends and family and people we know, and think, how are we hurting or helping that interaction? It's scary, don't get me wrong. It's scary to make eye contact with people you don't know, right? I mean, try that across campus. Make eye contact with everybody you come in contact with and say hi to half of them, especially the ones that are scary to you, and see what happens. What is that like for you for like 20 minutes walking across this campus? And you'll get an experience like that, right? So there's things that we can probably own a little bit. There's also pieces to our assumptions about other people. Sometimes we just assume the worst about other people. Addiction in the homelessness community is quite high, we think. I mean, it's hard to judge this thing, and mental illness is probably disproportionately high in the homeless community. For a lot of reasons. But we also know that in Utah, the more money you make, if you drink alcohol, the more money you make, the more you tend to drink. Let me say that again. The higher your economic income, the more you tend to drink statistically in Utah. So who are we worried about more here? I mean, this is the data stuff again. We assume that they are a threat to us, and yet they're a threat because we don't understand them, and they're hauling around a backpack on the street. And they may have some symptoms. I mean, we know this, right? They may talk to themselves and be worried and things, but we have to confront some of our own sort of fears about this in talking about the reality and the data.
Well, Andrew's quite right. One of the first things I learned when I started working with homeless people is a Salvation Army major told me when I took a group down to serve a meal, he said, give assignments to your church group you've brought down, Pamela. You stay free, and I want you to stand at the door and shake hands with everyone who comes in who's willing to shake hands, because that may be the only time that week that they're touched by another human being, or touched at all. And when you think about how much we touch one another, you know, I gave Sandra a hug. And I gave Sandra a hug because I have great love for her as a friend. I love what she does. I love who she is and her different roles in life. And it's a genuine hug of love and acceptance. with my homeless friends now who come and give me a hug. I hug them because I have love for them, and they have love for me. I have to tell you, in January, I was quite ill with pneumonia, and the messages that I got from my homeless friends sent through service providers about how much they cared for me and they wanted me to get better quickly. They're very capable of caring. And when they don't get recognized on the street, when somebody doesn't acknowledge them, a man from New York told me one day, he came in for a meal, that I was the first person who had touched him in a whole year. And he said, when I stand on the street and look at people, I don't get acknowledged as a human person. They avert their eyes. The way to help our homeless friends is to accept them, who they are, and to find out how we can help them. We don't say, you need this, you need that, you need the other. We say, what is it you need? How can I best help you? And it's very interesting. We started a program 15, 16 months ago, and it's just for our homeless friends. It's a devotional, a 10-minute devotional. And I have 15 different religious leaders, faith leaders, who come down to do a 10-minute devotional just for our homeless friends. We have burritos, we have bagels and orange juice. And many of them come for the food, eat and leave. But our attendance has now gone up from 6, 15 months ago, to 41 last week. And as I listen to the feedback, my homeless friends are saying, this makes us feel special. You know, thank you, Pamela, for organizing it. And I said, well, it's a team effort. It's a partnership with Catholic Community Services. But they feel a little bit special. And when people feel accepted and special, they get a little bit of hope. And it's that hope that is the beginning of the self-esteem that we can all work with to help people take those next steps out of homelessness.
You know, I think we have a tendency where we want to put everyone who fits this label in one box. And that's not the case with society, and it's definitely not the case with those experiencing homelessness. I've met individuals who are experiencing homelessness who never graduated from elementary school, and I've met someone who's homeless who had a PhD. I've met homeless individuals who used to be a college professor, and some who've never had a job because of intergenerational poverty and getting caught up in the drug cycle. And so we cannot place individuals all in one box. And we have to dispel that myth that all homeless people are homeless because they choose to be homeless. There are individuals who are homeless who are working. They get up every morning and go to work, but they're homeless because they can't find affordable housing. They're homeless for a variety of reasons. There's that intergenerational poverty. My mom was homeless, my grandmother was homeless, my family is homeless, that's all I know. And this whole thing about pull yourself up by your own bootstrap, let's dispel that myth. Everybody in here is where they are because somebody in life at some point took a chance on them, believed in them. Several people in my life I can name that took a chance on me and believed in me and believed in my talents and what I can do. And so to say, well, just pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, you know, I think is an insult. The question should be, what can we do to help you? Let's figure out what we can do to get you independent. Because if you would ask a person who's living on the street, they would tell you, I want a job, I want to work, I want to be independent. I don't want to be living on the system. I want that self-sufficiency. And so we have to start dispelling these myths around the homeless population and stop placing everybody in this one little tidy box that's comfortable to us.
So some really important things were just said. One is acceptance. So a challenge that was kind of brought to me before this event, but we're gonna put it out there right now, came from this a little bit. Next time you are wherever you are, and you see someone kind of going down the street and maybe their clothes are a little dirty or maybe they have a sign or whatever, say hello to them. You'll be amazed. You'll feel it. Because as Pamela mentioned, sometimes folks, we've rejected these individuals and we've lumped them into this, we've turned them into criminals, basically. Andrew pointed it out. We do a lot of things that if I were homeless doing those things, I would be considered a criminal. People experiencing homelessness are much more likely to be the victims of crime and violent crime, much more likely than to be the aggressors and to be the perpetrators of those crimes. So, very important here.
That's Rob Westman, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is panel moderator and Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Utah, Rob Westman.
Okay, so we have about 15 minutes. I want to talk to the panel briefly. What are some either solutions we're working on? Pamela, you mentioned a couple of things, but what are some things that we can really do or that we're working on to help improve the lives of people experiencing homelessness? And I want to start with Andrew. He's like, dang it.
I think housing again. I'm flippant about this, but anybody look for a house or apartment lately on the prices? Can anybody afford that? All right, maybe one person. I don't know.
I will say I'm very privileged thanks to the Road Home.
So, yes.
So there are some ways to do it,
there
but by and large.
It's difficult. I mean, it's really, really difficult. I mean, we have, a couple of years ago, there was a study said we are creating about 3 jobs for every 1 house we're building, 1 apartment we're building in this community. Wasatch Front. 3-1. At least 60% of our growth is our own kids. Right? It's not everyone coming in from out of state because of our great economy, and I love the governor and, you know, all the wonderful things he touts. But a lot of our growth and our strength is our own children and our grandchildren, and it's a wonderful thing. But we have to confront the fact that at some point we have to have more housing. And that means we're getting more compressed together. Density is a really dirty word in housing circles, right? We have very conflicted views about this. I really want to keep my quality of life, which means probably the way I envision it. A little more open space, bigger, those kind of things, and that's fine. And then we have to confront the reality also that it's incredibly expensive to build and maintain, and we're running out of room. We're running out of buildable land in Salt Lake County particularly, but Utah County is not very far behind. So we have to think about those things. As a city councilman, we'll talk about ideas here in the city, and with the administration and a lot of help, we've come up with about $5 million a year. We did a sales tax increase, right? Not very popular, but $5 million of that is going towards affordable housing in this city. Another $5 million every year is going towards public transit. Let's make it able to get around town without having to have a full car. I mean, it's got like $9,000 a year just to have a car. It's expensive to do these things. So from all of us in this room, number one, if you support or you're willing to sort of get around the idea of new types of housing, we need to hear from you. And I say that honestly because before I became elected official, somebody once told me that, if one person calls you or emails you about a subject, it's on your radar. If like 3 or 4 do, all right, this is kind of a big deal in my neighborhood. All right, I better sort of look into this more seriously and figure out what's going on. If like 6 or 7 people do, it's like the streets are burning. I mean, it's like Occupy Salt Lake City in my neighborhood that way. That's what it feels like, right? I represent 27,000 people in my little district in Salt Lake City. Think about that. If 7 people, if you and 6 of your family and friends were to call me and say, we really feel strongly about this issue, I would have a fire going. I'm ready to get going on this, right? That's a very sad commentary, partially on our current culture of participation, right? And our involvement in politics or in public policy. But on the flip side, it's incredibly empowering because you matter a whole lot. 27,000 people in my district, and when I got elected 3 years ago, we had about 2,400 people vote. Right? Well, it was actually pretty good, too. I mean, that's about 35%, I think, for the registered voters. That's pretty good for us. But again, think about this. Your vote and your voice to me as elected official or us matters tremendously. But what happens generally is when we have a public hearing on something, we'll get a crowd of people who are opposed to it. Maybe one or two people who are in favor of it, whatever, almost no matter what it is, frankly. Doesn't matter what it is, but we tend to get more energized when we hate something than when I kind of like that. That's a cool idea. But I'm not going to show up tonight and take time out of my schedule. I'm just going to hope this sort of happens. You got to be a little more proactive and positive sometimes in our participation. And you don't have to show up in person to everything. You can send emails or just call or text, whatever it is. My phone number is public, and maybe I shouldn't say that here, but it is. And for 3 years now, I've been giving out to anybody who asks my cell phone, and I almost get no calls. I mean, I get emails more often than texts, but it's not that scary. As an elected official, your voice is big. It's really, really big, bigger than maybe you think it is. Now, you may not get what you want all the time, but you can definitely get the conversation moving in a direction that matters. Look at us in Medicaid in the state. How many years in a row did Gene Davis run a Medicaid bill? Long time. Every year he ran the same bill, and every year nothing happened. Zero. And now we're getting some expansion. It's not hopeless. It takes time and persistence by people, but we can make changes that can really benefit us.
And I would like to add also to housing, we also need to look at livable wages in this state. It's one thing to be able to have a job, but it's another thing to be able to have a job where you're able to live. My daughter's a school teacher. At one time, she was working three jobs to be able to pay for her rent and to be able to support herself. She ended up giving up two jobs. She's just teaching now, but now she's back on my payroll. and so she's calling mom for groceries, and that shouldn't be happening. She should be able to support herself, and so we have to look at livable wage, and you know, she makes a pretty decent living, but then look at those individuals who are making, $7.25 an hour. The average person cannot afford rent on $7.25 an hour, plus pay for food and everything else that goes with being self-sufficient. And so we're going to have a serious conversation in this state about livable wage, and we also need to continue to create pathways out of poverty and giving people opportunities. A little bit bragging about the city, not just because I work for the city and my boss is here, but we do have a program and a contract with this one group of Advantage Services. And what Advantage Services, what they do is they hire individuals who are homeless or formerly homeless, and they give them opportunity to work. And that way they're able to start building their resume and giving them an opportunity to move up and hopefully out into another job where they are able to support themselves. And so I think we need to create more pathways like that for people to be able to get out of poverty.
In 2008, some of you may remember, we had a recession. And there are a number of people out on the streets who lost their jobs during that recession. And they're still waiting for those jobs to come back. And we've been telling people now since that time, since the recession ended, those jobs are never coming back. And the world changes, as you know. And so what we're trying to do, as Sandra mentioned, in terms of jobs, we have a group of businessmen who meet on a regular basis and are looking at how can we help homeless people find jobs. And a number of companies, particularly the construction companies, have taken some of our homeless friends and given them training and jobs. We still need many, many more of those. But for some of our homeless friends, they've gone to the applied technology colleges, and they have got certificates in automotive technology and computer technology, and they've graduated after 12 weeks and starting out at $60,000 a year. They never thought they were capable of it, but there are dedicated people who really want to assist people to get the help they need and to help them with learning. And our applied technology colleges, community colleges, are a great place for some of our homeless friends to start.
Awesome. So I think the important piece about that is that I love the opportunities piece, because I too have never talked to someone that didn't want to work and do for themselves, make their own choices, be independent. But we got to have opportunities, and when they're not there, we got nothing. So we got a few minutes for questions, and you had your hand up first.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Hi, Penn. About 2 years ago, I was commissioned by the New York Times, because of the evolution of the Operation Rio Grande, to capture images of some of the homeless folks in Salt Lake City. That ended after about 4 days, but what happened, and it's continued to this day, in addition to capturing images, I've developed a network, a true network of friends, people that they know me by name, they know me by when I'm approximately going to come visit with coffee, you know, that type of thing. But the question I've got, I have one individual that I've, you know, known for quite a period of time, but the first time, maybe the second time I met with him, how are you doing? Maybe some books I can bring, that type of thing. But he said, let me show you something. And sure, why not? He pulls out of one of his mini knapsacks a wad of Social Security checks that he had been receiving at his P.O. box. And I said, what are you going to do with these? There's a bank right across the street. You need to deposit them, get them out of your knapsack, earn some interest, and put yourself in a position to, you know, recreate a decent, livable environment. Well, and I'm interested to find out if this has happened elsewhere, but he, you know, I encouraged him, I asked him, let's go across the street and talk to an officer with his wad. Well, he wasn't about to do that. It was a comfort issue, not a financial issue, but a comfort with the system. And, you know, I've continued to lobby to do this, partly because he must have had $10,000-$15,000 in checks, some of which have come a long time ago.
Sure.
And the government, I don't know how they work, but they've probably canceled them for lack of deposit. I don't know how that works. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's one of my missions with him. And there's a few others that I'm truly friends with, mm-hmm, that have a pocketful, mm-hmm, of potential money to, yeah, help themselves out.
Yeah. So I'm gonna do my best to paraphrase.
Please.
So we do have folks with resources of some kind, but as we've all talked about, we need to make some sort of connection to assist with. I mean, so how many of you all have applied for benefits for one of your people you worked with? Is it easy? Has anybody done that in here? Oh my gosh, and I fancy myself reasonably functional. It's very difficult. And so part of that is trust in the system. I mean, if we think about the little T traumas and the developmental trauma over the lifetime, folks have just not gotten into a space where they trust folks. And then, you know, they get in a situation where they kind of don't know what to do. So I guess I'm answering it in terms of we've got to reach out to folks. We have to make that connection. We are encouraged by the new smaller resource centers that people have greater connection with folks when these kinds of situations come up. So let's get a couple more questions.
Yeah, thank you. Really quick, one thing that you brought up, Pamela, when you introduced yourself was that Senator Andrake brought up affordable housing bill, but it got squashed at the last second. I'd like to ask all of you, on a legislative level, on a city level, a state level, whatever, what needs to change in order for there to be real substantive affordable housing provided?
Okay, I spent some time with Senator Andrake that last night. He was really upset. we had been promised affordable housing money 3 years ago, 2 years ago, and this year, and we didn't receive it. We got zilch this year. But we have now been promised that it's coming in the special session at the end of spring, beginning of summer. And his big bill that asked for $24 million in total, it passed, but it has the policy in it. They have promised leadership up there to put the money there in the special session so that we can actually implement the policy as regards affordable housing. But there were some strong words said on my part, on Senator Andrick's part, to leadership on that last night. And they heard and they've responded in that way. So watch out for the special session and the housing advocates to be up there in full force.
And I think the number one thing you can do is call your legislator. I advocate for everyone, stay in contact with your elected official, with your senator and your representative, and let them know that this is important to you and you would like for them to push for this and you want them to support affordable housing. Because what happens is those individuals who may not see affordable housing in their communities or in a NIMBY community, their voice is getting loud. And they are contacting their legislators and saying, you know, we don't want this in our community. We don't want this in our backyards. And we don't believe in this. So you have to get just as loud and start contacting those individuals who are in the position to make those decisions.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Ginger Phillips. I have another question. And I want to thank all of you for the hard work that you do. I hear a lot about individually about all of you. I've worked with homeless kids for a long time. And Pamela, when you mentioned like that we need to work as a team, I am so with you on that, but it's not happening. I've worked within the homeless youth, within the homeless community. Then I went up and became an advocate for mental health care. Then I worked over at the Department of Health for Medicaid and the Medical Care Advisory Council. All of these communities are siloed off. I can call somebody at the VOA. They don't know what's going on up at the Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. Call someone over at the Department of Health. They have no idea what's going on at the Department of Human Services. I mean, it's not like we're really far away. Like, you know, so that part really concerns me because I've worked in all of these areas for a very extensive time and we're so siloed off. So I want to really ask, like, how can we, like, get people together? Because I am even talking to people now who went from the mental health field into the homeless, you know, population and advocacy, and it's siloed off. And the other thing is, instead of mobile crisis outreach team, which is awesome for crises, I am asking if you know about ACT teams for prevention, and if that would be feasible to learn about ACT teams before we get to the crisis point of needing MCOT.
Awesome. Okay. Okay. So working together, what should we do?
You know, the state, the county, the city, we are collaborating. We're trying very hard not to let egos get involved in this, and we're trying to literally work with one another. I mean, you can coordinate, but that isn't collaborating necessarily. But the roles seem to be melding somewhat. And when you see city and state people, city and county people working together, it's very different from what it was 2 years ago. We're tending to come down a little hard on groups that are working outside the team effort. We do honestly find that together everybody achieves more. And I love working with the city. They're very responsive. I love working with the county. And we've got a whole new design for the collective impact that the county was working on, and we're working with the state and all the cities with that. It's not just one city. Homelessness is a statewide problem. If somebody becomes homeless in Harriman, they're not going to stay in Harriman. They're going to come where the services are. So there were different bills that would assist each city in assisting a statewide approach. If you ever find any evidences of non-collaboration, just let us know, because we need to nip it in the bud. And incidentally, everybody can contribute sitting in this room. If I can put a plug in for the Homeless Trust Fund, there's a Homeless Trust Fund. It has my name attached to it, and Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. You know, if you contribute $2, you have everybody you know contribute $2. Just think of those $2 alongside thousands of other $2. And look at the money that could be used for working with people who are homeless, like case management, and emergency shelter, emergency food, and housing. But it takes a team to get a homeless person off the streets. And that fund on your tax forms, it is tax deductible, but that fund is one that helps all of our homeless friends, all of our providers. And as I said, it doesn't go to the state to work with it, that gives out to grants to all of our service providers. So that is what that is about. It's a very useful fund. I'm embarrassed that it's named after me, but the Speaker of the House, who did it some years ago, felt if it was a name that maybe more people would want to give to a name than just a title of Homeless Trust Fund. But believe me, we've all seen the outcomes, the quantifiable outcomes of people giving $2. And you can do it online. I don't know how many of you would do your taxes writing them out now, but online, there is a line for the contributions, and we'd appreciate you participating in that way. Thank you.
Awesome. Maybe quick summary.
Real quick one. So the coordination piece is true because we on the state audit just came out last year and said there's not good collaboration among all the entities, right? Which is true. And so one thing that is happening currently, which will be announced shortly, is a new organization that should consolidate at least Salt Lake Valley resources together, called the Salt Lake Valley Coalition to End Homelessness. Now, it should be inclusionary of anybody, anywhere who touches any issue around this. It's open and public. There will be a website, and I bet we can get the information out to folks.
Yes.
So everybody's welcome to join there and collaborate there in a coherent way. Now, an ACT team is Assertive Community Treatment Team. It's a nationally known intervention for folks who have serious and persistent mental illness long, long term. To the point where they just don't function independently. Now, it's a wonderful model. We have one at VOA. It works on the premise that it's much cheaper to help them long-term with the same team than have them jump from the police to the fire to the hospitals to the jail to the shelter and all around. It's very expensive to do this. Yes, I fully advocate that model for a small subset of this homeless population. I don't want to breeze over sort of the serious mental illness happening for a lot of folks we know on the streets, because it is happening. I just saw this other night at the grocery store. but there are ways that are proven that can help this if we will coordinate and put the funding towards it.
Brief summary, Sandra?
You know, I don't know what I can say that has not already been said. You know, just continue for those of you who are advocating on the behalf of those who are experiencing homelessness, please keep advocating on their behalf. Continue to be that voice, because that's what I pride myself on doing, and bringing issues and bringing light to a lot of individuals, my colleagues in particular, who may not understand the whole dynamics of being homeless. And so I was just going to encourage you to continue learning and continue growing and continue to be that advocate.
Great. So I want to thank Councilman Johnston, Representative Hollins, and Pamela Atkinson. Thank you.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.